Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have the pleasure of talking with author Fred Stopsky about his new book titled Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in Hell. This is a satirical fiction that provides intellectual and hilarious commentary about the current political administration. So a little bit about this author. Fred Stopsky is a Bronx-born author and educator. He is an unabashed liberal who boasts of having never voted for a conservative candidate, although among his heroes are Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Wendell Willkie. Fred admires those who not only believe in and support our Constitution, but are committed to social justice in society. Fred just completed his 50th year as an educator on June 1, 2007. He taught in college teacher education programs for 40 years, and then for 10 years taught in high schools ranging from New York to California. He decided to abandon his education writing and focus on satirical political books due to his concern about the deceit and hypocrisy that is rampant on the American political scene. He agrees with Franklin Roosevelt that the only thing one has to fear is fear itself, although cynical politicians today attempt to frighten Americans. He has a strong commitment to members of the military and wants them returned home as soon as possible. Fred Stopsky has tremendous faith in the intelligence and social conscience of the American people and knows they never will surrender to the forces of fear. So I am just so happy to have Fred Stopsky on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Fred.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, great. Well, we are so delighted to have a chance to talk with you about your book. You know, I read that you were born and raised in Bronx in a working-class family during the Depression, and I've heard that you really hold true to this era's commitment to social justice. And, you know, before we talk about your book, I'd like you to just talk a little towards your background and why you decided to gear your life's work to the realm of politics at this time.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, about a year ago I wrote a book on about George Bush being captured by aliens trying to find out how his mind worked, and that didn't work. More and more I became intrigued by Rumsfeld and Cheney. Last week, former President Bush made a very interesting remark when asked about, you know, why his son has so many problems. And he said it had to do with, quote, his advisors, unquote. Mm-hmm. And I think he's referring to Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, which sort of fit into what I thought, that the two of them had done a lot of manipulation behind the scenes. And I wanted to dig into them. And the book really presents in a kind of satirical manner how these two men, I think, have done tremendous damage to our nation. Mm. So I think that was behind my efforts to get into the two men.
What about your own personal background? What is it that drives you to really explore the realm of politics?
Oh, I was raised in a very political area of the Bronx.
Yeah.
All of my friends and I were very interested in politics. During the Depression, that was very common. And my boyhood really is spent in World War II, you know, as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And politics are always around you. So I think I was raised in a different kind of a climate. You know, when I was a boy, there were 13 newspapers in New York City.
Wow.
Today, there are four.
That's incredible.
And you know, most cities in America only have one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the world has changed, I guess, because of Internet, MySpace,
mm-hmm.
Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
People communicate differently.
Mm-hmm.
I have some of the old-fashioned aspect.
You do. Well, talking about communication, I mean, political satire is a form of a very strong form of communication. So why did you decide to address the key issues affecting Americans politically through books like this?
I think people are tired of being preached to.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are being tired about people giving long speeches. So Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney Hell, it's in the form of dialogues, people arguing. And I love arguments with people, and I want to present different viewpoints. So the book is not Fred Stofsky saying, I'm right, everybody else is wrong. Like, I've got a wonderful chapter with Ann Coulter, and I think I got into Ann Coulter's mind presenting the way she defends Rumsfeld and Cheney. So I want the people to hear both sides, but in a conversational approach rather than one of these very serious tomes that, frankly, nobody reads.
Well, why don't you tell us about the storyline of your book, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Hell? Give us a synopsis.
Sure. It takes place when Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney wind up find themselves awake in hell, where Ken Lay of Enron fame has been told by the devil to find out, do the two of them belong there? And so a host of people come down, like Ann Coulter, Anne Franklin, Giuliani, Pat Buchanan, and so on, who offer evidence for and against. And then in the book, we do a Jon Stewart show down there, a Howard Stern show down there, Bill Maher, Jay Leno. The object is to mix a lot of satire, humor, dialogue going on. And basically, I believe if anyone listens to the different viewpoints, they'll come to the conclusion, as the book does, basically, I believe, that the two of them do belong down there rather than up here.
Yeah, absolutely. So why did you choose just Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney for this book? You know, there are a number of major players in this administration.
Well, I'm more and more convinced that the two of them did a great deal of manipulation. You know, it's very interesting that President Bush will not fire his Attorney General Gonzales, even though his own party says the man's incompetent. And I believe it's because he's afraid a new attorney general will appoint a prosecutor to look into what Cheney and Rumsfeld and the others did. And my hunch is it might wind up leading to impeachment proceedings. So I see there's a real effort right now to protect these two men, their incompetence, and the secret things that went on behind closed doors.
So you think this is a pretty big cover-up?
I mean, somebody's going to have to explain why the President of the United States won't even listen to his own party, which says the Attorney General is totally incompetent. And the only explanation that I can find is you don't want a new Attorney General.
Right. So in your book, what are the crimes or injustices that Rumsfeld and Cheney are being accused of?
Well, I think, one, that they have failed to really adhere to the Constitution. You know, I went into the military, and one of the first things you're taught in the military is you must obey the Geneva Conventions. And the two of them have totally thrown it out the window, which goes against everything in American history. I think their efforts to subvert freedom of speech. I believe the two of them are the most radical individuals we've ever had in government, and you can throw Bush in. In fact, one of my chapters, I have Pat Buchanan, who is a wonderful conservative, who right now is appalled because he believes, not Fred Stofsky, Pat Buchanan believes, that Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush have violated the Bill of Rights, have put government into the lives of people. So I don't think it's just, quote, a liberal saying this. I think a true conservative also shares my feelings. I think another aspect that they're guilty of is deliberately lying about the famous weapons of mass destruction and why we had to go to war in Iraq. You know, by the way, in one of my chapters, I have the law and order unit go there, and if you really want to know the truth about weapons of mass destruction, you have to read that chapter. It's the whole truth. I made it up.
I've heard about your chapter with the law and order, and this is a very critical aspect of the book, so it definitely, you talking about it will entice readers to check that out, because it is very, very humorous.
You know, if I can sum up in a certain sense, I think there are five key points in the book. One, that our Constitution's basic liberties have been violated. I think a second point that comes out in the book is fear and hysteria have been used to frighten people and silence critics. You know, I think a true conservative like Pat Buchanan welcomes critics, Today they're called traitors and so on. I think a third point is the deliberate lying to the American people. Mm. You know, there is one lie after another. A fourth point that really concerns me is the betrayal of our fighting men and women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the figure now is going to hit $3,700, $3,700 dead just this week.
Wow.
By the whole point. And by the way, people don't understand another thing. There are 120,000 contractors doing work that historically were done by the military. 1,000 of them have died.
Is that
so in reality,
right?
We're almost approaching 5,000 dead.
Mm.
And I think the last point I was trying to get across is that these two men, Rumsfeld and Cheney, are not in tradition of American executive leaders.
Mm.
You know, the point I mentioned several times in the book is, if you go back to World War II, President Roosevelt appointed Republicans to the cabinet because he wanted to have this nation united.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me, George Bush keeps on saying he's the decider. I think he's the divider.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a current theme in the book, that the nation should have been united after 9/11. And we all remember it was. Remember the wonderful feeling of community?
Yes.
And I think that's been destroyed.
Yes.
And I think the three of them have to take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't call your opponents traitors and un-American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the crushing things to me was when this Democratic senator, I think it was from Alabama, Georgia, who had lost both arms and both legs in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they accused him of being a traitor.
Mm.
And here is, you know, Dick Cheney, who says he got 5 draft deferments in Vietnam because, quote, I have better things to do, unquote.
Wow. That's so incredible.
Yeah, to me, I have a very strong feelings for military people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were involved in the military yourself.
Yeah, I was there in the 1960s. I worked with Vietnam War veterans, training them to be teachers. In fact, I set up the first program for returning Vietnam War veterans.
Mm.
And I really care about the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the book, there's a chapter on Pat Tillman's death,
mm-hmm.
which, as you know, in the last week or so, all the stories are coming out about his death again.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I did a lot of research on Pat Tillman, and I was so impressed. You know, he was a very bright and articulate boy. For example, in one thing I found, he heard about the name Karl Marx. He went ahead and read all of Karl Marx's works.
Mm-hmm.
He was that kind of kid. And he gave up all those millions of dollars to fight for his country. And these people used his death to get votes. I mean, that to me is beyond the pale.
Yes.
And I feel so much sympathy for the Tillman family that they had to go through this.
Mm-hmm. And now, I understand that was actually, you know, a big inspiration for you writing this book, was
yes,
the death
yeah.
of the young military men and women.
Yeah, it, you know, they shouldn't be there, and in all honesty, you know, I often go on MySpace and read people saying, bring the boys home tomorrow, and the boys and girls aren't coming home tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
There was a wonderful comment by the Democratic Congressman Joe Sestak, who was an admiral, and he said, it's going to take a year to get them out. He pointed out something I didn't realize. There are 64 military bases in Iraq that have to be closed down.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
That is a lot. How many?
Then he said something else that really shocked.
I wonder how many there were before the war started.
No, these are ones that we built.
These are new.
These are ours.
Wow.
And then he said something that totally threw me. He said, there are 20,000 vehicles. Each one has to be cleaned thoroughly to prevent contamination from coming back to America. So I'm thinking, my God, you know, these young men and women are going to be stuck there
mm-hmm.
for another year, year and a half.
Mm-hmm, at least. Yeah. Wow. So how do you work into your book the military forces that have fought or even died in this war and their families, and protecting their ideas in a sensitive way, but mixing in your own opinions?
Well, I try to do in the Pat Tillman chapter, and mm-hmm. There are the military runs through a lot of the other chapters in which people raise issues about what's happening there. And I think part of the difficulty is there's been so much cover-up. And, you know, I read the military papers every morning. It's the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting how increasingly the percentage of letters to the editor has switched from supporting the war to opposing it.
Yeah.
So that's a theme I ran through almost, I'd say, 10, 12 chapters, the feeling about the soldiers and what's going on with them.
Mm-hmm. You know, many would say that there is an extreme lack of media reports regarding the opinions of military and their families. And not only that, just the devastating effects in Iraq as well and the innocent people there. What are your thoughts on the current media coverage?
Well, I think the media has done an absolutely horrible job of reporting the war. If you remember, initially they were embedded and they were reporting all these glorious things.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem, it's interesting, last month the Danes left Iraq, the Danish troops, and they had to bring 500 Iraqis with them because they were afraid they'd get killed.
Wow.
And nobody talks about that we're going to have to take about 100,000, maybe, Iraqis home with us because if we don't, they'll get killed.
I haven't heard
I think
that.
It's stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the media portraying everything as wonderful until the troubles began. I think part of the difficulty is so many Americans today get their information through the 6 o'clock news, which on the average has about 3 minutes of hard news, and they get it on, you know, MySpace, Internet, and so on. We don't have excellent writers who go into depth dealing with some of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it as one of the great differences between my childhood and present times. Very rarely do you get excellent writing that looks in a critical manner.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I'm finding the media in Germany and England much superior to what's going on in America, reporting what's going on.
I've heard that. I've heard that a lot, that once you get outside of the U.S. borders, you can really get some interesting takes when you look at the news coming out of different countries. So where do you go for your news?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I read every day German newspapers like Der Spiegel.
Mm-hmm.
I read English newspapers. Each morning I read about 30 newspapers throughout the world.
Wow.
That's my daily regimen.
That's an interesting point of view that you get.
Yeah. For example, in the German newspaper Der Spiegel, they had a devastating interview with the former head of the CIA in Europe, which I never saw reported in America, in which he told everything
Wow.
about what he did.
Wow.
You get materials like that. I've been reading newspapers from Iran, trying to get their viewpoint. Again, I find there's an absence of an American media of presenting opposing viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
We have so few newspapers today compared to the past. You get one viewpoint, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, right now I'm living in St. Louis, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch used to be a great newspaper, and now it's just nothing.
Mm.
So somehow we're going to have to invent another way to help the American people get more information.
I think so. Do you think we're kind of rounding that curve right now, though, with the Internet and the alternative media that we can find with various websites and blogs that are popping up?
Absolutely. I think we're living in the beginning of a revolution.
Mm-hmm. I've
and I don't
that.
Know where it's going to end.
Yeah.
It's like one of the things I'm more intrigued with is, will we get virtual reality where you can actually be part of the news event?
Well, there's a concept.
Yeah. I saw a virtual reality program a few years ago in which you go into the Constitutional Convention and you talk to people like Hamilton and Ben Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, wouldn't that be wonderful today if actually you could have a virtual reality program where I'm in Iraq talking with soldiers?
Yeah, no kidding.
So I think that's coming down the road in the next 10, 15 years. I think we're going to see dramatic new ways to help people learn about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So getting back to your book a little bit here, you know, the devil in your story calls on several witnesses to make his ultimate decision. And, you know, most of these witnesses that you've chosen are famous celebrities, but not necessarily politicians. So how did you decide which celebrities to use?
That's a good question. I sort of come to the conclusion that in modern times, we take comedians seriously and politicians we think are comedians. But, you know, I watch the Jon Stewart Show every night, you know, the Colbert Report, as do millions. And so I wanted to include people who are actually, whether I like it or not, giving the American people news.
Yes.
So that was one factor, and I thought, and like Howard Stern. Millions listen to Howard Stern and probably get their ideas on all sorts of social and political issues. I guess the book was trying to capture modern life, that we're going to use celebrities, whether we like it or not, to begin to be the ones we look for advice. When I go on MySpace, I find the majority of people on MySpace will listen to Jon Stewart, you know, or the Colbert Report, rather than reading a newspaper. So that was part of the factor of bringing these people into the book, because the reality is they are the ones giving information to the American people.
They really are. Why do you think that is? Why don't we trust, or why can't we get our information from what we typically would think are the news sources? It seems really backwards.
Well, I think it's a whole host of reasons, certainly. The speed up of modern life, the fact that this generation are not newspaper readers. I mean, if you look at circulation figures, that's obvious. This generation gets its news from internet, you know, all these other factors. I think we are witnessing the end of newspapers as we know it historically. So, again, that's one of the reasons I was trying to get in the book, the new forces of information. And I'm not saying necessarily you like them. I'm a great believer in being practical. You have to face the reality of your life. That's where life is going. I just, you know, I was teaching at a college in New York, and I was teaching students this last semester who are going to be social studies teachers, okay? So I asked them, how many of you read a daily newspaper? Of the 24 people, three raised their hand.
Wow.
And they're teaching social studies.
Wow.
I bet what I just said, any college professor in America right now who is working with student teachers, if they ask that question, they'll get pretty much the same response.
That is low. Well, what do you think of the current blending of pop culture and politics? Have you seen, or in all of your research, is there any comparisons to this in history?
I suspect no.
Yeah.
I really think there's a revolution occurring. Remember, the penny newspaper that we know today began in the 1840s or 50s. So before that, there really weren't, I mean, there were newspapers, but nothing mass scale. So the whole idea of mass scale, you have to go to the 20th century, the movies, then radio, you know, TV, and so on. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the first television. And, you know, at 11 o'clock p.m., not a.m., it all went off. And if the joke used to be some people would sit there looking at the blank screen, figuring something was going to happen. But this is a, think about it, it's 50 years in human history.
Yes.
The whole revolution has begun.
Yes. Yes.
So I think it's totally new.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more and more convinced we're just at the beginning.
Yeah, and who knows where it's going? Don't know. So I want to talk a little bit about your blog and the mission statement that you have on there. I want to read just a little excerpt. It says about you, I believe in a liberal view of the world. A liberal is one who is concerned for the rights of all people and does not believe fear is an excuse to silence dissident voices. So, you know, you had mentioned the whole idea of fear. fear of the system, fear of this administration as being one of the five topics that you really wanted to cover in your book. And I'd like you to talk a little to the concept of fear and the dangers of a nation in fear and how this ties into your worldview.
That's a very powerful point. You know, I'm born in 1930. I often joke with my children, I was conceived after the stock market crash.
Mm.
I guess my parents had nothing else to do. So I was raised in my first 10 years of life, basically 11, where one out of three people didn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we survived. You know, believe it or not, crime rates went down
wow.
in the Depression.
Wow.
Yeah, nobody had anything to steal.
Right.
So I, as a child, I lived through World War II. Like, the week after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had 10 aircraft carriers, and we had 3.
Mm.
So I lived at a time when there was real fear, but the President of the United States kept on saying, don't worry.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I learned that despite calamities, if you keep calm, you know, you'll work your way through it if you keep a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one change I see today. To me, it's the politics of fear. The attitude right now in Congress, I don't think most American people realize how acrimonious are relations between Democrats and Republicans. This is a totally new thing in American politics. You know, when Ronald Reagan was president, most people don't know, once a week, he played poker with the Democratic leaders in Congress.
Is that right?
And they joked and smoked cigars. That era is all over.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened with the Clinton administration when Republicans really started getting nasty.
Mm.
And my hope is that whoever becomes president next year will end this attitude. This is not what we Americans need.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need anger and hatred between people in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they have to agree, but they don't have to be vicious. And again, I'll blame Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush for creating the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look what they did to John Kerry, who fought in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I mean, that was outrageous.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree with him, but you don't do that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. In 1940, Franklin Roosevelt defeated a Republican called Wendell Willkie. And a few months later, he appointed him to go on missions. And throughout World War II, he kept on using his defeated opponent to do missions for the government. What if Bush had done that with John Kerry or Al Gore?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'd have the same attitude.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what do you think, you also mentioned is one of the things...
I'm sorry, could you speak a little louder? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. So what you also mentioned earlier, that one of the topics in your book, too, was the Constitution, the breakdown that you see going on regarding the Constitution. What were your opinions about the Patriot Act that kind of came and went and, you know, there wasn't a whole lot in the media about it?
Yeah, I've been fascinated on MySpace. There are hundreds of comments coming out by young people
mm-hmm.
who are shocked at the manner in which the bill was, you know, passed again without any real debate. Again, you know, in England, the new Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, is trying a different approach. He has said from now on, basically, he's looking at terrorists as criminals, not as necessarily those who represent some huge force.
Mm.
I think the Patriot Act has given incredible power to government like never before in American history. I mean, they can check the books we read at libraries. They can check our, you know, daily conversations.
Yes.
It's interesting. Pat Buchanan, conservatives like that, are against it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think conservatives see this as a threat to their freedom because they ask a simple question. What if tomorrow my opponent is in control of the government. Now, my opponent can monitor my life.
Yes.
And I think a lot of Republicans who don't trust Democrats, what if the Democrats win in 2008? Do you want Hillary Clinton monitoring what you do?
Yeah, right.
So to me, anyone who believes in the Constitution realizes it's not Republican or Democrat, it's our liberties. And, I find they're under great attack. I'm not saying that it's never happened before, that we haven't had problems before, but today with modern technology, they can get every aspect of our lives.
So, Fred, what is your response to those who would say that you are unpatriotic or your book is unpatriotic?
Well, again, it comes back to what do we mean by patriotism? See, I believe as an American, it's my solemn duty to oppose government I don't agree with. You know, when you enter the United States military, you take an oath of allegiance. The oath of allegiance, by the way, is to the United States Constitution. You promise to uphold and defend the Constitution. So I feel I'm duty-bound as an American to oppose those who I consider to be violating my Constitution. And I would hope that if a Democrat was in office tomorrow as president, that Republicans oppose that individual, criticize them. By the way, most people don't realize during World War II, we had vigorous debate. We held an election in the midst of the Great War, where 14 million people were serving the armed forces. We had elections.
Mm-hmm.
People argued.
Mm-hmm.
Our nation survived.
Yes.
And I find the present attitude that if you oppose the president, well, I wish some people would go back, for example, and look at what Republicans said about President Truman during the Korean War. There's nothing today that compares with that viciousness of attacking Truman. So, to me, I expect you, if you don't agree with the president, please oppose the individual.
Mm-hmm.
That's an American.
So what are your thoughts on 2008? You know, some say that this is going to be one of the most critical elections in U.S. history.
I don't see any perfect candidate, but I'll be honest, I on my blog I keep on saying I'm for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I'm for Hillary Clinton-Obama ticket,
mm-hmm.
Barack Obama, for a couple reasons. I think, I asked the question the other day on my blog, if you had to choose somebody to represent the United States at a meeting in which the future of the world was being decided, who would you send? And I thought of Hillary Clinton. I don't agree with all of her views, but she's calm, she's intelligent, she is steady, and I think she'll use her intellect to solve a problem. I think where this society, is beginning to come into the whole reality of global warming. This is the future of all of our children.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to find new ways to deal with poverty throughout the world and so on.
Mm-hmm.
At present, I see Hillary Clinton as the best candidate. Also think symbolically for women, it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I think somebody like Obama is very important for all people who are minorities.
Mm-hmm.
I see the two of them as very symbolic people who inspire future generations. And by the way, I think they'll inspire young Republican women, which is important.
Yes.
So, I'm a great believer that symbols sometimes help a society to move forward.
Interesting. Talk a little more towards that, because these two candidates definitely...
I'm just having a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry. I'll try to move my mic a little closer, Fred.
Okay.
I'd like you to talk a little more towards that symbolic nature of Hillary Clinton and Obama, because, I have heard that before, and this really is somewhat unprecedented in recent elections.
Yeah. I've got three daughters and a son. I think my daughters need symbols in their life. One of the most amazing things that's happened in America over the last 20 years is we've moved from having to be concerned about getting more women into college. Right now, 55% of college students are women, which means that in law, medicine, and so on, a majority in the next 30 years will be women.
Wow.
I think that's a revolution. I was a single parent at one point in my life. I raised my two young kids by myself. I learned what it's like to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I learned one thing that we men sometimes fail to recognize, like a single mother, what that person goes through. And I think the women of America need to take leadership. And I see more and more of them moving that way. There are women prime ministers in Norway, and they've been in England. You know, all over the world, it's happening. For some reason, we Americans have been a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, by the way, please don't get me, I don't think women are necessarily better or worse candidates, but it will inspire the next generation of women to be much more politically active, and that means the whole country benefits.
Yes, yes. Interesting. So, you know, we're kind of ending our time here, and I just wanted to offer you to share any words you'd like to on the recent reports, the very recent reports of Karl Rove stepping down. What are your thoughts there?
I think Karl Rove, his hope is that an attorney general doesn't get appointed to look into what he did
for
the last 6 years. I'm sorry if I'm laughing, but, you know, I think right now he's probably done the best thing for himself.
Mm.
But it's, if you want to use a terrible cliche, it's almost as though the rats are leaving the ship.
Yes.
And I think others will leave soon.
Yes.
But we haven't seen the end of this.
Mm.
The story of Karl Rove will not come out till about 2009.
Mm. Till after
there will,
there'll
be investigations.
Yes.
And I think we'll see for the next several years more and more coming out.
Have we ever seen anything like this in history with so many people moving on, jumping ship, as you say?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Have we ever seen this in history with so many people in an administration jumping ship?
It has happened before. You know, it's not uncommon for people to leave, but I don't think we've seen so many leaving with the threat of investigations lying over their head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I personally think Bush has made a terrible mistake not getting rid of Alberto Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, his party is saying get rid of the man. I think he'd be better off having a prosecutor appointed while he's president. Who's a prosecutor going to get appointed by Hillary Clinton is going to be maybe something he doesn't want.
Yes.
But that's his decision.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes wonder, you know, about Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush in this way. Did they talk with one another about what they thought might happen in Iraq? Did they look at alternatives? Did they reach out and get good advice? And the only conclusion I think I have in the book is no.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they did it on the seat of their pants.
Mm-hmm.
And made it up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is unprecedented in American history.
Mm-hmm.
To go into war with that kind of attitude.
Yes. What about ulterior motives as well? Do you think that there was any of that going on?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
What about ulterior motives as well, not just not communicating, but, you know, maybe there was secret agenda? I don't know.
I believe this or not, when Bush won this disputed election in 2000, I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. I would argue with people saying, well, look, in America, we accept. You know, we believe in the fairness of elections, and though I don't like the outcome, let's respect the man. I think from day one of his presidency, he never grasped the meaning of being president.
Mm.
A president is not president of Republicans. A president is president of the United States of America.
Mm.
That means you must show respect to those who oppose you and disagree with you.
Mm.
Neither one of these three men has that attitude. I think this is unprecedented in American history. I didn't agree with Ronald Reagan, but certainly he always listened to his opponent. He sat down and talked with them. And if you go back in American history, over and over again, it's that attitude.
Mm.
It's like, there's a recent story coming out about President Eisenhower. who was raised in basically a segregationist world and didn't totally agree with Brown versus Board of Education, which ended segregation. And some new evidence is coming out that he basically said, although I don't agree, I'm president, I'll enforce the law.
Mm.
That's what Bush never understood. That's what Rumsfeld never understood. And that's what Cheney still doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You must respect your opponents.
Yes, absolutely. So, Fred, where can readers get Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in hell? What's your website? Actually, it's your blog site.
Okay, you can get it at www.theimpudentobserver.com. That's www.theimpudentobserver.com.
Mm-hmm.
Or one can go to Amazon and get it there.
Mm-hmm.
Officer, we'd love you if you could come to our website.
Yes.
Again, it's one more time, I get a plug.
Yes, please do. Please do.
Okay. www.theimpudentobserver.com. That's www.theimpudentobserver.com. And again, if you wish, you can get it through Amazon as well.
Okay, great. Now, I know right now on your blog you're selling both this book and your first book, the George Bush satire,
right.
George Bush on the Planet of Zool. I believe you're selling those two together?
Right, yeah.
Okay, great, great. Now, can your books be ordered through online bookstores, Fred?
I'm sorry, say that.
Can your books be ordered through online bookstores or through local bookstores?
Probably not. It's really going right now through Amazon and our website.
Through internet. Okay, great. Well, you know, Fred, we have to wrap things up here. This has just been such a great interview. I thank you for your time. But do you have any final thoughts you would like to share?
Yes. I'm hoping in reading the book, people get to reflect on their own personal values as Americans. And if you disagree with me, if you feel that I'm unfair, at least I hope you respect that I did present viewpoints of both sides, which I think, as Americans, that's our responsibility. At no case did I ever just say, I'm the right and you're wrong. You get a dialogue throughout the book. You get opposing viewpoints. So I'm hoping that those who oppose me will take a look at the opposing viewpoints, see the other side, make your own decision.
Mm. Great final thoughts. Thanks so much for your time, Fred.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay. Thank you very much, Renita.
Thank you. All right. There you have it, listeners. What a great, great interview with author Fred Stopsky. The book, once again, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in Hell. His blog, theimpudentobserver.com. We sincerely recommend that you check out Fred's work as well as his blog. He's got some very interesting things up there. So for a recent book review as well and an online interview, you can go to readerviews.com. So thanks so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.